Okay, so the plan for today is to learn about differential forms. So it's going to be the main topic. There's some things that I may add if we have time at the end, but they're still related to differential forms. Before we start, can anyone see what I'm writing? Is it big enough? Do you want me to write bigger? At any time, if you cannot see because it's too small or my handwriting sucks, please let me know. Also, are there any questions about previous material or the course, the things that we're going to do? Okay, then let's get started. Feel free to just ask questions at any time. Okay, so the first thing I want to tell you about is some abuse of notation that we're going to use. Now, we've seen that a covariant tensor, the way we defined it, is something that acts on vectors. So a covector is a map that acts on vectors, and a tensor of rank 0k acts on k vectors. Now, the question that I want to answer is, if we have a covariant tensor field, which is pretty much a map that assigns to each point in the manifold a tensor, does this act on vector fields? The way we defined it, it doesn't, because it's just a map. Right now, this is something that takes a point in the manifold and attaches to it a pair of points. And that's going to be in the tensor bundle, is something like this. So this acts on points, it doesn't act on vector fields. It is useful, though, to have a notion of how to act on vector fields using covector fields, for example. So to do this, we're going to abuse notation and introduce a new map on which we act on this tensor field, so on the vector field. So if this is our tensor field, and we have xi that just goes from m to tm, so these things from I equal 1 to s. These are going to be our vector fields. Then we would like to define the action of t on x1 all the way to xk, or xs.
Can you go through this one more time, why covariant tensor fields are not acting on the covariant field?
Yes, so you're asking why covariant tensor fields don't act on vector fields. So the way we define the covariant tensor, a tensor at a point is some map that goes from, at a point m, it's going to go from tm, m times tm, m a bunch of times to r. So the way we defined it, this is naturally something that takes vectors as inputs, spits out a number. Instead, the tensor field takes a point as input on the manifold, and it gives us a tensor. So right now, it doesn't actually feed on vector fields. So to fix that, we just need to define, when I write this, what do I mean? And that's why it's an abuse of notation, because technically, this is not a function acting on this. In some sense, we are using another function that takes t, maps it to something that acts on vector fields. We don't want to have a lot of extra symbols. So we're just going to use the same notation. And this thing is going to be a smooth map. We cannot assign a number because it's going to depend on when we act. This is a tensor field, so it's a function acting on points. The vector fields also act on points. So this notation is going to be the smooth map that takes a point m and associates to it the tensor at point M evaluated on the vector at point M, and then the other vector at point M, and so on. So it's nothing weird, they just, we didn't talk about it, and we're going to use this concept a few times, so it's good to know about it. Yes?
Do we ever let it be, let there be an empty slot, or do we always fill them in?
You could have empty slots if you wanted to. I don't think we're going to need it for what I'm planning to do, so I'm trying to keep things as simple as possible. Also, the same idea works. I am using covariant vector fields, tensor fields. You can use any tensor field. Just do the same thing, just swap vectors with covectors. I don't need it for non-covariant tensor fields, so I'm not doing it, but it's easy to generalize. Okay. So we now have what we need to define differential forms. We're going to say that a differential is usually implied, so we're just going to call them k-forms. A k-form is a tensor field of rank 0k. So it's going to be a covariant tensor field, which is why I talked about covariant vector fields only before. Which, in addition to being a tensor field, is also totally antisymmetric. A totally antisymmetric means that if you swap any of these inputs, you're going to get a minus sign. If you do two swaps, the two minus signs are going to cancel out and nothing changes. And that's for any inputs. That's why it's totally antisymmetric. The reason why I talked about all this is that the inputs I'm talking about swapping are these ones. When you feed it vector fields, if you swap any two vector fields, you get a minus sign. Another way of writing this is that if sigma is a permutation. I don't know if you're familiar with this notation. This thing here is called the symmetric group. And the symmetric group is the set of all permutations of k elements, if we're looking at the symmetric group with the k, so we have 1 to k. And the way we think of this is usually maps that go from this set that are invertible. So we're mapping 1 to k back to 1 to k in an invertible way, which means we need to send 1 to something else, 2 to something else, but we cannot send two things to the same, and we need to get to everything. So if we have a permutation, if we have our omega, which is a k-form, and we act on tensor fields, and we permute the indices. So we have x1 to xk are tensor fields. But now I'm going to act, or we can do this. So we have x1 to xk tensor fields. If I do x of sigma 1, I'm swapping some of the indices. So if there was 1 before, now maybe this becomes 3. And the next one becomes 4 and so on, just in a way that all of the indices are accounted for. So if we swap some of the things, this is going to give us the sine of sigma, which I'm going to explain in a moment what it is, times omega of x1, xk. The sine of sigma is going to be plus 1 if sigma is an even permutation, minus one if sigma is an odd permutation. There are many ways of defining what even and odd means. We're just going to think of this as being the number of swaps that the permutation has. So if you swap only two things, that's going to be an odd permutation, because we're swapping an odd number of times. If you do two swaps, then it's going to be even. If we do three swaps, it's odd. If we do four swaps, it's even, and so on. So this encodes the idea of total antisymmetric. If I swap any two things, I get a minus sign. But if I swap them twice, then I get two minus signs, and they cancel out. So this is what differential forms are. There are other ways of defining them, but the way we're looking at them is just a special kind of tensor field. Any questions at this point?
I still have some confusion when it comes to, like, you were saying why we're looking at the B1 and to the antisymmetric. You said that, you know, when I swap it once and twice, then it would be like two minus sign, and it would be a plus, so it would be equal to each other. Like, if it's also symmetric, it would happen, right? If it's like swapping once, it would be symmetric instead of antisymmetric. If I swap it twice, it also would be the same thing.
Yes. So if you just have something which is totally symmetric, it's the same idea, but anytime you swap something, it doesn't change. You can define something like that, and then you get something which is not a differential form. So differential forms have a lot of nice properties, and they follow from this antisymmetry thing. So if you don't require this, then you don't get any of the nice stuff that comes with differential forms. So right now, it does kind of seem like there's not much point in doing this, but we're going to see there's a lot of reasons why this antisymmetry is important. So some of it we're going to see it right now during the lecture. Some of it you'll see it in the tutorial this afternoon. So hopefully it's going to be clear then why this is a useful thing to talk about. But right now, just some strange definition that we're using. Okay, so some more notations. I'm going to call omega k of m the set of all k forms. And just by convention, omega 0 of m, so the set of 0 forms, is going to be the same as the set of the smooth functions that go from m to r. This one may be a bit weird to think about, because now we don't even have the concept of we feed the vectors, we swap them, because it's 0 vectors. We're not feeding it anything. So it's a bit strange, but this is essentially the same idea as saying 0 factorial is 1. It's just a convention that turns out to actually be useful and make things work very nicely. So we're going to assume that this thing makes sense, and then you're going to see that things work out just fine. And the last thing that I want to say, and this is going to feed into the next step, is how do we talk about these things locally if we are in a chart? So if we have a chart U with coordinates xi, then omega is going to look like this, just because it's a tensor. Can you still see here? Is this covering up anything?
Can you raise it a bit?
Yes. Is good? So this thing here just comes from the fact that it's a covariant tensor field, so we can always write it in this form. This thing here is a function, and these are just the coframe fields tensored together. Now, the fact that it's antisymmetric means that these functions here are totally antisymmetric. In the indices. So same idea as before. If I do swap two indices in this thing, I'm going to get a minus sign. If I swap an even number of times, I get a plus sign, odd number of times, a minus sign.
Why did you require it to be antisymmetric? I think you've probably explained it yet, but can you explain it again?
Yes, so why do we require it to be antisymmetric?
Yeah. What if it was symmetric? Or anything?
You could have it. So you will just have a tensor field which happens to be symmetric. You can construct a set of only the symmetric tensor fields, but then it's not going to have the structure which I'm about to give the k-forms. So right now they're just tensors with some strange property, but it turns out that the strange property allows us to introduce some extra operations, and that's going to be useful for a lot of things. So right now it's not obvious at all, but it's going to be obvious hopefully at the very least by the end of the tutorial today, maybe even by the end of the lecture. Any other questions? Yes.
Since omega I 1 to ik is anti-symmetric, the tensor product should also be anti-symmetric.
Can you repeat that?
The tensor product should also be anti-symmetric.
Okay, so you're asking, should the tensor product be anti-symmetric? So actually, that's the next thing we're going to talk about. So right now, the tensor product is just a tensor product. So it's not anti-symmetric. If we swap two things, we get a completely different tensor. If you forget about this, if I have dx tensor dy, this is a completely different object than dy tensor dx. They're just two different things. They're kind of related, but they're different objects. So we do want to create something which is kind of like the tensor product, but if you swap two things, you get a minus sign. So that's the next thing, and to do that, we're going to need to introduce the wedge product. The wedge product is a new kind of operation we can add on differential forms. And it's a way of taking well, let's write it as a function. We're going to do something that goes from to omega p of m times omega q of m. So we take two things. One is a P form, the other one is a Q form. And we want to map this to a P plus Q form. So we want to take two forms, make another form out of it, which has a bigger rank. It's kind of like the idea of the tensor product. If we have two tensors, and then we multiply them together, get a bigger tensor. It's a similar idea, but we want to do it in such a way that if I have two forms, P form and Q form, then I end up with another form. If I just use a tensor product, I end up with a tensor, but not with the differential form. But if alpha and beta are forms, then alpha tensor beta is not a form in general, but a tensor. So we need something that instead preserves this idea of being differential forms. There are many ways of doing this. We're going to use a coordinate-based approach because it's a bit simpler. So we're just going to start defining what this operation is, which I'm going to denote by this little wedge, by saying what happens on a coordinate basis. So I define dxi1 wedge, dxi2 wedge on wedge dx ik, which at this stage we're just going to think of as being a symbol. This is just going to be the sum over all permutations of k elements. And then we're going to take the sign of the permutation and multiply it by dx sigma I1 tensor dx sigma I2 tensor all the way to dx sigma ik. So we're taking this as the sum of all the possible permutations, and we put a minus sign if we got a permutation with an odd number of swaps, plus otherwise. So this is exactly what we're trying to do to make that thing be anti-symmetric.
You said the tensor product is not a form because if you put the tensor products together, you have two coefficients whose indices are not related to each other. So
yes,
if you swap them, you don't get the anti-symmetric version.
Exactly. You may end up in situations where swapping doesn't give you the minus sign. If one of these things is just a function, then they will work. We didn't talk about that, but you can have also tensors of rank zero, and then they will be just functions, just the same way as differential forms of rank zero are functions. And in that case, this works. But otherwise, it's not going to work, generally speaking. If one of them is zero, then it works. But that's kind of a trivial case. Just one warning, there are different conventions. Some people put a 1 over k factorial in front of here because that's the dimension of the set of permutations. So you account for the fact that you're repeating things. So I'm using this other convention just because we need to do symplectic geometry, and we're using two forms. If we do this instead of the other one, we just keep a bunch of factors of 2. But there is no right way of doing this. So just keep in mind that you may encounter other conventions. So we define this, and then if I have a generic form, I'm not going to rewrite it, it's just the same as this thing here. If I have a generic K form, which is written in this way, now I want to write it in terms of this wedge product symbol that I wrote here. So we have omega was omega I1 to ik, and then we're summing the x I1 tensor dx ik. Now, because we're summing over all the indices, it doesn't matter if I also permute all of the indices. So I can just write with an additional sum over all permutations. And this time I do have to put a 1 factorial, 1 over k factorial, because I'm summing over extra stuff. So I'm essentially doing this thing k factorial times, because I'm summing over all possible permutations of these indices and these indices. So I'm going to have omega of sigma I1, sigma ik, dx, sigma I1, tensor, dx, sigma ik. And we still have the implicit sum over I1, I2, and so on, using the Einstein summation convention. Is this step clear to everyone, why this makes sense? OK, so once you have this, we're going to use the fact that this is totally anti-symmetric in the indices, which means that doing the permutation sigma I1 all the way to sigma ik is the same as taking the original one, omega I1 all the way to ik, and multiplying by either plus 1 or minus 1. So this is going to be 1 over k factorial sum over sigma in sk, and then we have the sine of sigma, then we have omega I1 to ik, and then we have dx sigma I1 tensor all the way to dx sigma ik. But this thing here is exactly what I've wrote up there. And the omega doesn't depend on sigma, so we can just take it outside of the sum. So this ends up just being 1 over k factorial omega I1 to ik dx I1 wedge all the way to dx ik. If I had chosen the other convention, the 1 over k factorial would have gone inside the definition and would have disappeared. So you're going to have it one way or the other. It either appears here or it appears in other places. It's just a matter of where you would like it to appear. Okay, so that's what Vassalia was asking before about, should these things be antisymmetric? In this expression, they are not, but if you write things in terms of the wedge product, then this thing is antisymmetric and so is this thing. Now, one thing to note is that this symbol, because of the fact that we have the permutation, if we swap two things, is going to give us a minus sign. If we swap more, we're going to get plus or minus depending on the parity, which means these things are not all independent. I cannot just do, just let's think in two dimensions for simplicity. In two dimensions, I'm going to have only two options, because if I do dx wedge dx, this is zero. Because it must be antisymmetric, but if I swap it, I get the same thing. So the only way that can give me a minus if is this is zero. Same thing for dy wedge dy. And then dx wedge dy is the same as minus dy wedge dx. So in this case, I really have only one of them, which is non-trivial, and that's this one. And if I have three dimensions, then it's the same idea. I have to always have distinct things. So if any of these are repeated, I get a zero, because then swapping them wouldn't change anything. So this means that if I want these, each of these things to be independent, I just want to select a few independent of these wedge product bases, then I can do it by essentially choosing I1 less than I2 less than IK. I can always, if I had to choose one of them, since they are up to permutations the same, up to a plus minus sign, so they are linearly dependent, I can just choose to have them ordered by index. And I use the strictly less because I want it to be distinct, otherwise I get zero. How many ways can I choose these ordering? And remember that these are indices that come out of the set 1 all the way to n. Because these are just indices of coordinates. So I have n possible coordinates, and I need to pick up the index of the coordinate. I need to pick up k of them, ordered one smaller than the other, all different. How many ways can I do this?
So n choose k.
Yes. So the number of possible ways is n choose k. So we're going to have n choose k independent of these things, the I1 wedge all the way to dx ik. So this tells you that any k form can be written in terms of just n choose k specific k forms. So they kind of form a basis for k forms in the same way as the frame fields and the conframe fields do. So it's not really a basis of a vector space, but that tells us, and that's exactly what's happening in this expression, that any k form can be written as a combination of functions which multiply these things, of which there are n choose k independent ones. So if you wanted to, one thing you can do is say that omega is the sum for I1 less than I2 less than ik of omega I1 yk dx I1 wedge all the way to dx ik. So if you do it like this, you're only summing over the independent ones. And that's why the factorial disappears, because if we're not accounting for the fact that you can swap all the orders, we are choosing a specific order, the one in which I1 is less than I2, less than IK. We're not really going to use this very much, but it just to give you the idea of why we can use these things as a basis for our K forms. I want you to remember this fact that we have n over k for this afternoon, because one thing to notice and to remember is that n choose k is the same as n choose n minus k. So we have k forms and n minus k forms that kind of have the same dimension in the sense that they have the same number of generators. So this is something to remember for this afternoon, because we'll see how to go from one to the other. Okay, I just have a few more things to tell you about wedge products, and then if you have any questions, you can let me know. Okay, just some properties of the wedge product that I'm not going to prove. They are easy to prove if you're really interested in proving them yourself. So the wedge product is bilinear. Actually, I didn't define the wedge product, sorry. I just defined how it works on basis. If I have two differential forms, one of them is of the form alpha 1 to I1 to IP dx I1 wedge dx IP, and then I have another one, beta, I have J1 all the way to JQ dx J1 wedge dx JQ. If I want to take the wedge product of these two forms, I just define these to be this new differential form. I have alpha I1 to IP beta J1 to JQ, and then I have dx I1 wedge the way to dx IP, and then I do wedge dx J1 wedge all the way to dx JQ. So I'm essentially multiplying these two expressions together by putting a wedge in the middle. And now, unlike the tensor product, this thing does give us something which is antisymmetric, because even though if I swap an index from here with an index from there, these two things don't talk to each other, so we don't get a minus sign. The minus sign comes from swapping in here, because now these things themselves are antisymmetric. So this thing is indeed going to be a differential form. And because we have these are P and these ones are Q, we put them together and we get a P plus Q form. So properties of this thing, the wedge product is bilinear, as you can easily see by the definition. The wedge product is also associative. And if I have two forms, alpha and beta, assume that they are like before, so alpha is a P form, beta is a Q form. So if I have alpha wedge beta, if I want to swap them, I'm going to get potentially a minus sign, and the minus sign is going to be minus 1 to the P times Q times beta wedge alpha. So if I want to swap two forms when I'm taking the wedge product, I may get a minus sign and I may get a plus sign. And that depends on the rank of each one of these forms. So if I have two one forms, if I swap them, I get a minus sign. If I have a one form and a two form, if I swap them, I'm going to get a plus sign, because I'm really doing two swaps in order to go from one to the other. And the last thing is that the wedge product is preserved by pullbacks. If f is a function that goes from two manifolds M and N, and alpha is a K form on N, then f star of, well, alpha beta we have also beta is an S form on N, then the pullback of the wedge product is just the wedge product of the pullbacks. Technically, this idea requires that the pullback of a differential form is also a differential form, which we really didn't talk about. So that's another property that happens. This one is easy to see. We've already seen that pullbacks of covariant tensors are covariant tensors. And the antisymmetry property is preserved by the pullback. We're not doing anything weird there. So this is just something that happens. We're not going to go improve it, but we may have to use it at some point. So it's good to know this property exists. Okay, so that was all about wedge products. Do you have questions about what we've done so far before we move on to the next thing?
Was pullback defined for tensor fields or for tensor covariant tensors?
Yeah, so the way we defined it was for covariant tensor fields. So it works because these are a special kind of covariant vector field, sorry, covariant tensor field. So the pullback of a differential form is going to be a covariant tensor field. And then the antisymmetry is preserved by the pullback. So it's going to actually be a differential form. Yes?
If F is like a local diffeomorphism, can I push forward and it still be compatible with the wedge?
So you want to push forward using?
If F is a diffeomorphism.
OK, so if F is a diffeomorphism, yeah, so the push forward is not going to act on differential forms. Oh, so you want to use, yeah, so you want to use the F inverse, yes. So then it's going to work because it just, if F is a diffeomorphism, then F to the minus one from N to M is also a diffeomorphism. So you can use that to now pull back things from M to N. Okay, so the next thing I want to tell you about is just something that happens on a very specific kind of form, which is top forms. Now, top forms is just a name that we sometimes give to N forms. We call them top forms, and here N is the dimension of the manifold. We call them top forms because we cannot go any higher. If we try to do an N plus one form, that's going to be zero. While we can have tensors of rank n plus one without any problems, because of the antisymmetry property, we cannot do this. Because if we do dx I1 all the way to dx I k plus one, sorry, we said n plus one. I only have n indices to choose from. If I want to choose n plus one of them, I need to have at least two of them that are repeated. And if two of them are repeated, this thing is zero. So I cannot have n plus one forms, n plus two forms, and so on. So the highest I can go are n forms. And so we call them top forms. And also, n choose n is one, which means that if omega is an n form, then it's particularly easy to write it. Yes?
Sorry, so is this in like n dimensions? You can't.
Yes.
In n plus one form?
Yes, so let's write it somewhere. N is the dimension of M. So if omega is an n form, then there's only one. Like you might want to write it in the same form that we've written before. Like something like this. And then you're going to have n indices, and then you're going to have n indices there. but there's only one independent choice for this. Remember the idea that we can write them using the sum and we choose them ordered instead of doing everything, but there's only one way of getting n ordered things, and that's 1, 2, 3, and so on. So this means that omega can always be written in the form f times dx1 wedge all the way to dxn, where f is a function that goes from m to r. So top forms have a particularly easy expression because they're just a function times this thing, at least locally. And one thing that we want to see that's useful for when we talk about integration is what happens if we change charts. If we change coordinates, so we want to go from coordinates x to coordinates y, for example, and we try to do the same thing, then what happens to omega? Omega is going to be f, or let's just see what happens to this thing here without worrying about f. Dx1 wedge all the way to dxn is going to end up being dx1 over dy I1 applies dxn over dy in, dy1 dy I1 wedge dy I n. And I'm just using the transformation formula for the coframes. So dx1 is going to be dx1 over dy I1 times this. I do it for all of them, use the properties of the wedge product, and you're just going to end up with this. And now we're going to do a few manipulations. If we write down explicitly what this is in terms of tensors, we can reintroduce the sum over the permutations. So this is the sum over the permutations sigma in Sn. Then we have the sign of the permutation, the product of all these things, dx1 over dyi1 all the way to dx. N over dy I n. And now this thing here is just going to be d. Actually, I'm skipping a step. Sorry, this is going to make it more difficult for me. So let's skip this step. What we're going to do is this. When I'm summing over I1, I2, all the way to in, this is right now a sum over all possible values of I1, all possible values of I2, I3, all the way to in independently. But if I choose I1, I2, all the way to in, not all different, then this thing is zero. Because I1 to in need to be distinct. I have n of them. If I want this to not be zero, then I need to sum only over the distinct ones. So I'm actually doing a sum over I1 different than I2 different than in of this thing, dx1 over dy I1 dxn over dy in. And the same thing here. Is this step clear? And doing the sum over over all the distinct things is the same as doing the sum over all permutations of only the permutation of 1, 2, 3, all the way to n. Because doing the all possible permutations means that we're swapping all possible things by keeping them distinct. Yes?
Can you repeat one more time why here we don't have to account for like the overcounting that we did there? Is that really just because they're distinct?
So the overcounting, you mean the k factorial?
Yeah.
So in here, all I'm using is essentially the properties of the wedge product. So I kind of skipped a step, but if you do, let's just do one of them. So I have, let's see.
Why are you requiring the I1 should not be equal to I2? If they're equal, it gives just a plus zero. So you could put those into the sigma as well if you wanted to.
You cannot put them to the sigma because sigmas are permutations. In the sum, yes. I can. So I could put them into the sum. I'm removing them because then this sum is the same as the sum over permutations. I want the sum over permutations because I'm going to use that to get rid of the fact that we have a lot of indices. It's going to make things simpler. So that's the plan. So back to what I was saying, the idea of why this is working is just a definition of the wedge product. If you write this, I skip one step, but you will write this as dx1 is dx1 over dyi1 dyi1. They're just a formula to go from one of the coframes to the other. Then I have this wedge dx2 over dyi2 dyi2. Wedge all the other things.
What was overcounted over there? I'm forgetting.
What was overcounted was the fact that we were going from an expression in terms of tensor coordinates, the components of the tensor, to the components in terms of the wedge product basis. That's really not something that you generally have to worry about. Because I can always just say that alpha looks like this. I can just start with this and say alpha looks like this. The only thing is that if you think of it as a tensor, then these are not the components of the tensor. You have an extra key factorial that appears. But that's the two conventions essentially are either, the two choices are either if, so for example, say the electromagnetic tensor, you could write F equals F mu mu dx mu tensor dx nu. And if you want to write it as a differential form, then you need to write 1 half f mu nu dx nu wedge dx nu. So you have the 1 half appearing here. But you can then write things such as dx wedge dy equals dx tensor dy minus dy tensor dx. So you can either do this, or you take this 1 half, and instead of having it here, you have it there. So you have these two formulas. One of them is a 1 half, one of them doesn't. And it's your preference which one does and which one doesn't.
Oh.
It's just a choice. The 1 half is going to appear anyway. You just have to get to choose where you want it to appear. OK, so going back to this, so the sum over all distinct indices is the same as the sum over all permutations of just 1, 2, all the way to n. So we're going to get the sum of dx1 over dy sigma 1, and then dxn over dy sigma n, dy sigma 1, wedge dy sigma n. The reason why we did this is that this thing here is the same as just the sine of sigma times dy1 wedge all the way to dyn. Because this is just a permutation of this thing here. There's only one thing for the basis of n forms. So if we permute them, eventually we can get back to this. And if we swap an even number of times, we get a minus pi plus sign, otherwise a minus sign. And now, this thing here, the sum over all sigmas of sine of the permutation, and then we're going to have these products, this is actually a formula for the determinant of a matrix. When you do the determinant, you end up multiplying things, and then you sometimes put a minus sign, sometimes a plus sign, and that's exactly what this does. This is a very bad computational formula for determinants. It takes a ton of time because you have to do all the possible sums. But as a just formal expression, it's great because it tells us that this is just going to be the determinant of the x over the y, by which I mean the Jacobian matrix. So it's the matrix that has as elements dx I over dyj times dy1 wedge dyn. So going from these coordinates to the new coordinates y just gives us a determinant of the Jacobian as a coefficient, and everything else stays the same. Now, this might remind you of something, and that something is the coordinate, the change of coordinates formula for integration. If I'm doing an integral and then I switch coordinates, I want to go from Cartesian to polar, I'm going to get an extra determinant of the Jacobian factor inside the integral. So this suggests that differential forms are things we can integrate over because they transform in the proper way. Technically, there's a problem, and the problem is that this determinant can be negative, but the change of coordinates formula has an absolute value of the Jacobian. So there's something that we're going to worry about later when we talk about integration of manifolds, but it's going to happen later this week. Questions so far? Yes.
Why when moving from partial x1 to partial y1 to those things below, partial x1 to partial y sigma 1, why that one also doesn't introduce a sine sigma?
So this one doesn't get the sine sigma? So when we go from this line to this line, I'm just using the fact that summing over all possible distinct indices is the same as summing over all permutations, because the possible values that sigma 1 to sigma n can have is all possible indices, but they're all distinct. Because I have, let's just do the simple case of three things. If I have three indices, 1, 2, 3, what are the possible permutations? The possible permutations are keeping them the same, which is the identity permutation, and then I can swap two of them. I can do 2, 1, 3, and then I can swap two of them, and so on. I get six of them. And that's the same as the sum of all distinct ordered indices. So that's why I can go from here to here. And you don't get the sign of the sigma because you're not swapping anything. You're just summing over all possible choices. OK, so next, we're going to define another operation, which is the exterior derivative. So we have a wedge product, which is something that takes two forms and gives us another form. The exterior derivative is something that takes only one form as input, one space form. I don't mean a one form. So we can take a K form, for example, and we associate to it a K plus one form. So this is another thing that lets us go from one form to a higher degree form. And the reason why we call it derivative is that it's somehow related to derivatives. So let's see how it's defined. Again, we're going to do things in coordinates, although you can also do things in a more abstract way. If you're interested, just feel free to ask. So the way we define it is by saying what happens to zero forms, first of all. So if f is a zero form, which is the same as just a smooth function that goes from M to R. Then we're going to say the df is just going to be df at over dxi times dxi. And this was our notation for the coordinate representation of f. If things are not, like if you're not going to be confused about things, you can also skip the at. I'm just going to keep it so it's clear what we're working on. So this kind of makes it look like this is the differential that we use in calculus. The nice thing that this thing actually makes sense. There are no infinitesimal quantities. You don't have to worry about things that are vague. These are linear maps. These are just things, at least at each point. This is just a tensor of rank 0, 1. So there's nothing weird about it. A more abstract way to define it is just saying the df, when it acts on a vector field, is the same as the vector field acting on the function f. If you're interested, this is a coordinate-free way of defining this thing. And then, if we have a form that looks like this, we have alpha i1, alpha ik, dx i1 wedge dx ik. So if I have a k form of written in coordinates, then d alpha is simply going to be the derivative of the coordinate representation of these components. So d alpha i1 yk over dx j. And then I just get an extra dxj in front of everything. Dxj, dx i1 wedge dx ik. So I am adding this extra thing. By convention, we add it in front. We could have chosen it so that it goes at the back, but the convention is to add it as the first argument. And this thing is going to be a k plus one form because we now have an extra thing in here. So this is just the way we define it in general. We have to do something special for zero forms just because this thing does not really appear for zero forms, although it kind of makes sense anyway. Yes?
Sorry, could you go back a few steps? I don't really understand why the exterior derivative of a function acting on a vector space is the vector space acting on the function.
OK, so this thing, just an aside, just in case you're interested. So if it's not clear, you can also ignore it. It's just a coordinate-free way of doing this. Remember that we talked about vector fields as being derivations. So they are things that act on functions. So these in coordinates, if x equals xi d over dxi, then this is telling us that x acting on f gives us xi df at over dxi. They're just the way the action works in coordinates. And this thing, just the way we defined it, is actually going to be, we can, because this is linear, we can pull dxi out. So we have xi df acting on d over dxi. But this ends up actually being the same, is xi df at over dxi. Well, we are defining how this works. So we're saying that this equals, sorry. So this, we're saying that it equals just this part. So these things are the same. And acting on the frame basis gives us the components in terms of the coframe basis. So just a way to do things, the same thing as this without coordinates. But it's not really important. For our purposes, the coordinate expression is enough. Okay, so this is the way we define it. And the properties we get out of this definition are the following. D is linear, just coming from the definition, because if I have any scalar number in here, or I have a sum of two of these things, they go through the derivative because the derivative is linear, and then you just get the sum passing through. So D is linear. Then if alpha is a P form and beta is a Q form, then the derivative of alpha wedge beta is going to be the derivative of alpha wedge beta plus minus 1 to the P alpha wedge d beta. So we kind of have something which is the product rule with respect to the wedge product. So when we talked about vector fields as derivations, that was the property that defines derivatives, being satisfying the product rule. This is almost like a product rule. So it's not a derivation, it's something more generic, which is called the graded derivation. And that's why we call this the exterior derivative, because it satisfies something which is related to derivatives. Another thing that happens is that d squared is zero, in the sense that d of d alpha is always zero for all k forms. No, that's my terrible handwriting over Q. They can be anything. It doesn't really matter. The only thing that matters here is alpha. Because when we're doing this, you're essentially doing a swap, and the only the first thing matters for this swap. So this is something else that happens. This is not difficult to see. If I go here and take another derivative, I'm going to get a derivative with respect to xk, for example. But now I have a derivative with respect to two possible indices. And because everything is nice and smooth, I can swap the order of derivation. So you get a symmetric thing in front, and then you get an anti-symmetric thing here, because you're going to get xj wedge xk, and it gives you zero. So this is something that happens. And another thing that happens is that the pullback of the exterior derivative is the exterior derivative of the pullback. So both the wedge product and the exterior derivative are preserved by pullbacks, which is great, because remember when we talked about pullbacks, and we talked about a bit of this at the tutorial yesterday, we usually use pullbacks to take structure from one set, from one manifold, bring it back to another one. But this kind of structure is intrinsic into the manifold, because if we pull it back, it stays the same. It doesn't matter what we do. The exterior derivative is preserved by all kinds of pullbacks. So it's not something that we take from one place to another. Manifolds already have it to start with. And one last thing I want to say about exterior derivatives is this. They actually make our notation finally come together. If I have the functions xi, they go from u to r. These are just our charts. They are the components of a chart. If I think of these functions as just being functions that go from a subset of the manifold to the real numbers, then I can think of them as zero forms. And if they're zero forms, I can do dxi, and this is going to be a one form. And this one form is exactly the one form dxi. So the things that I call dxi, the coframe elements, are exactly the exterior derivative of the coordinates charts. So the d appearing there was not just a symbol, after all. It was actually the exterior derivative acting on functions. And in particular, this tells you that d of dxi is always going to be zero. It also comes from the definition, but if xi is a zero form, then d squared is going to be zero regardless. Yes?
But, like, a little weird. So, like, yes, if you take two exterior derivatives, you get zero. But here, the exterior derivative takes us from like k forms to k plus one forms. But it's a little, it feels a little weird that you can't just keep getting, you know, k plus two, k plus three. that just...
You can. So when I said it gets to zero, zero is, in this case, is a two form. Oh. Just a very trivial two form, but it's still a two form. It's just zero times dx one wedge dx two, for example. Nothing stops you from multiplying by this. It just, we write zero because it's essentially the zero vector in a vector space. So you are actually going up, it's just that you get zero, which is something to be expected because you cannot go up all the way you want. Eventually, you're going to reach a top form. If you try to do the zero derivative of a top form, you cannot get anything other than zero, just because there are no n plus one forms. Yes?
I have a question about the first property of the external derivative. So let's say if the alpha is a top form, then its external derivative will be always zero.
Yes.
Then that means the pullback of the top form.
Define external derivative to...
Yeah, so you're asking the pullback of a top form. Yes, so the pullback of a top form, if you're pulling back to a manifold of less dimension, is going to be zero. If you pull back to a higher dimension, it's going to be something whose external derivative is zero. It's not a top form anymore, but it's just going to be, well, I'm going to say that in a moment, but it's going to be what we say is a closed form. And this is actually something that happens. The pullback of a closed form is always a closed form, just because of this property right here. So that's the only thing that happens. It's nothing weird about it. The fact that it's a top form is actually irrelevant in this case. It just, it's a form that has d alpha equals zero. And if you pull it back, it still has the d pullback of alpha equals zero. Other questions about this? Okay, so there are just two very easy things that I want to add about this exterior derivative. And we have quite a bit of time, so we may be able to go and do something which is a bit extra. But first, let me tell you about this. Just some definitions. If alpha is a k-form, we're going to say that alpha is closed if the alpha is zero. And as we were saying before, top forms are always closed. Simply because you cannot go any higher, so it must be d alpha equals zero. Or if you want, if you look at the definition, whenever I do this for a top form, I'm going to add an extra wedge product. But that index must match one of the other ones because you only have n indices. And then we're going to say that the form alpha is exact if alpha equals d beta for some beta in omega k minus 1. So these are just names that we give to things that satisfy these specific properties. This is a very important concept because it has a lot of ramifications. We're not going to go in any of those, but it's going to be useful for some things, so it's still useful to know what this means. And one thing to note is that just by using the property that d squared is zero, exact always implies closed. Because if alpha equals d beta, then d alpha equals d squared beta, which is always zero, no matter what. And the big question about differential forms is whether the other way around is true. If I have a closed form, is that always going to be exact? And this is very much related to the idea of conservative fields that you have seen many times before when studying physics. So since we have time, I think I'm going to go a bit into this and giving you some examples to see what's happening. Now, this thing I'm about to start is kind of an extra thing. I wasn't planning to do it, but then I realized we didn't have enough material for today. So we're going to actually start talking about a little bit of integration in a very easy way. So before we start this, any questions about what we've done up to this point?
Yes? A way to remember like the meaning of exactness? Like, is there a reason it's called exact?
As far as I know, it's just a name. I don't know if exact is used for a specific reason.
Okay.
I mean, it's a property. We need to give it a name, and the name that was chosen is exact. Okay, so to do the next thing, which is really just, I want to show you an example of something that might happen, of forms which are close but not exact. But to talk about that, I need to talk about integration first. So one forms can be integrated over curves. So to do this, we first need to define this for a very simple manifold. So let's start with the manifold, which is just the closed interval AB in R. This is a manifold with boundary, as we've seen yesterday. You have done this with 0, 1 in one of the examples. It's the same thing, you just shift the endpoints. And if omega is a one form on M, I'm going to need charts. So I'm going to have a chart which is just T that to a point X in AB, actually in AB without extremes, attaches just X in R. So I have this chart, which is just really the identity map restricted to the open interval, plus other charts to cover the endpoints. We don't actually care about the endpoints. It's important that they're there, just because this way we're sure that the integral converges. But we don't actually care about what happens at the point. Just you've seen in your calculus courses, the integral of a function of the endpoints, it doesn't actually matter if the endpoints are in or out. It's going to be the same, as long as it converges. So any form can be written at least when restricted to the open interval AB, can be written in the form some function times dt. We're just writing things in coordinates. There's only one coordinate. And we're then going to use, just as a definition, the integral over the manifold AB of omega is going to be the integral from A to B of f of t dt. That's just how we define this integral. Because right now, this is just a symbol. What does it mean to integrate a one form? In this specific case, it just means write it in terms of that coordinate basis. And just to the integral as a normal Riemann integral over R. So nothing weird happening. And this integral is always going to converge because f is a smooth function. And the interval it's defined on is actually compact. So everything is great. So why do we do this? The reason why we did this is that now we can extend integration over curves on any manifold. So now M is an arbitrary manifold. And I have a curve, gamma, which goes from is something of this form. So it's a function that takes t in ab. So I'm going to consider curves that include the endpoints. You don't have to, but for our purposes, we're going to, so everything is nice and everything converges. And it sends it to some point gamma of t of m. And we want this thing to be smooth. This is essentially a parametric curve on a manifold. We have a parameter which lives in some subset of the real line. And to this parameter, we attach a point. This could be a physical path of something and a t is time, or it can be just some curve that we parameterize according to some parameter, which doesn't mean anything. If we have this, then I can define, and sorry, one extra thing, I have a one-form omega on m. Then I'm going to define the integral of the one-form omega over the curve gamma. I'm going to define it to be the integral over the interval AB of the pullback of omega, using gamma as the pullback. Gamma is a function that goes from the manifold AB that we defined before to m. So we can use it to pull back the form to a form on AB. And now we know how to do this because I defined it right over there. And in general, if gamma star omega defined just restricted to AB is of the form f dt, then this is just going to be the integral from A to B of f of t dt. So we have a very simplified way of integrating things. If we want to integrate more complicated things, this is not going to cover it. We're going to see that later this week. But for now, this gives us some form of integration. Yes? I think Batsalia first had this.
Is this trivial why gamma star omega is FTT?
This gamma star omega?
Yeah, why the pullback gives you like FTT?
Because in general, gamma star omega is some one form on AB. And one forms of AB are least restricted to the open interval are of the form FTT. For some f, I didn't say what f was, it just is going to be for some function f, it's going to look like that.
See.
So the point is that even if I don't exactly know what omega is, it must be when I pull it back of this form for some function f. I don't know what the function f is at this stage. In the example that I'm going to show you, we know what it is, just right now we don't. Now, why am I telling you all this? What does this have to do? Yes.
So this is for one forms. Is there a notion of integrating over two forms or arbitrary k forms?
Yes. So in general, you can integrate a k form over a k dimensional manifold. So a curve is a one dimensional manifold because right now it doesn't look like it. But if you look at all the points in so the image of this curve, there's going to be a subset of M. And it ends up being a manifold of dimension one. So in general, you can integrate k-forms over k-dimensional manifolds, which really means you integrate top forms. It's just that in this case, when I'm doing this integral, the top form is rank one. That's the only thing I can do. That's why it's so simple in this case. But you can do then two forms, you integrate over surfaces, and three forms over 3D things, and so on.
Could you also integrate like a one form over a 2D surface?
You can't.
Okay.
So you need to, if you want to integrate over a manifold of dimension k, then the form needs to be a top form in that manifold. So it must be of the highest dimension. The dimension needs to match the dimension of the thing you're integrating on.
Okay.
Just because you need integrals to have the change of variables property, and that only happens with top forms. But we're going to talk about that later this week. Now we're just doing this simplified example just because it tells us something very important. Yes?
Defining a subset of M in that manner with the parameter, are there any subtleties in thinking about it as a submanifold of M, or is it always M?
Not in this case, because we have used the compact thing here, so there shouldn't be a problem. So that's not going to be a problem in general, I think. So for, because you have something parametric, so you can always do this thing with parametric things. Is when you have stuff that's more difficult than parametric. Parametric curves are kind of the easiest curves we can have because we have them explicitly. We know all the points. Not all curves can be parametrized. And if you cannot parametrize them, then you need to worry about more subtle things. So the endpoints in this case are going to be fine. So the map gamma is smooth. So if you think of this as a topological space and this as a topological space, this is a map between topological spaces, and it's going to be continuous because it's smooth. And continuous maps are going to map compact things to compact things. So the image of this thing is going to be a compact thing in M. That's why we can integrate without worrying about stuff. Okay, so the reason why I did this is that, and now this is going to be something familiar because you have seen it, just not in the language of differential forms. If I have a form omega, which is exact, so omega is of the form just d alpha. So this is on M. Then if I try to do the integral over a curve gamma of d alpha, this is actually going to be f of gamma of b minus f of gamma of a for some function f. Which means that the integral of an exact form is only dependent on the endpoints of the path. So you've seen things like this. The integral of a conservative field over a line is going to only depend on the endpoints. That's the same thing, but in the language of differential forms. So that's where exact and closed are related to whether something is conservative field. So a conservative field is, if you think of it as a differential form, is something which is exact. And closed is something like asking that the divergence of a vector field is zero. And naturally, you're going to see exactly this at the tutorial this afternoon. So then the question is this enough to imply that F is conservative? This is actually also a question, if you're not talking about differential forms, just you're talking about integrals in R3 or R2, or it doesn't really matter. This is, the other way around is always true. Conservative implies that the gradient is going to be zero. The other way around is generally true unless something breaks things. And that something that breaks things is being closed but not exact. So we're going to see an example of this. We probably have enough time. I'm not going to actually prove this just because I either prove this or show you the example. I think the sample is cooler. But I'm going to put the proof in the lecture notes. So if you're interested, you're going to find it in the lecture notes. OK, so example. This is the most classic example of a field which is a differential form which is closed but not exact. So the only example I know of is this one, is the one that everyone shows everyone else. So the manifold is going to be R2 minus the origin, also known as the punctured plane. So we have a plane, we remove a point. The differential form is going to be x dy minus y dx over x squared plus y squared. This is well defined because we remove the point zero, so this thing never blows up. So this is actually a nice, smooth thing. You can check yourself, just a little bit of annoying algebra because you have to do derivatives, that d omega is zero. You just use the product rule a bunch of times, eventually things cancel out and you get zero. So this is a closed form. So now the question becomes, is this form exact? And in this case, it's not going to be exact. So this thing is equivalent to saying that the gradient of a vector field is zero. Yes?
Do you see that it's not exact?
We haven't seen it yet. Okay. I'm going to show you how to see it's not exact. We're going to use this property. We're essentially doing a proof by contradiction. Okay. If it is exact, then this holds. But this doesn't hold, then it's not exact. So we're going to come up with a curve, gamma, which takes t in 0 to pi and associates to it cosine t sine t in m. So the curve is just a circle. I have my puncture plane doesn't have this point. My curve is a circle, which I think I'm going on counterclockwise, but it's not really important. One thing to note is that this curve is closed. It has the endpoints mapping to the same thing. Gamma of 0 equals gamma of 2 pi. And you're going to just end up here four times, which means that if omega equals df, then the integral over gamma of df equals 0. And that's because the integral only depends on the endpoints and is some function evaluated at one point minus function evaluated at the other point. But if the points are the same, then you just get something minus itself and you get 0. So this is the thing that says the conservative fields don't, or over closed paths, always give you 0. It's just the same thing done in the language of differential forms. OK, so the only thing we have left to do, which I think we have just enough time to do, is computing the integral and showing that it is not 0. So how do we compute the integral? We need to do gamma star of omega. So gamma star of omega, because of the properties of the pullback of differential forms, is actually going to be the pullback of x times the pullback of dx minus, x dy. And then we have minus pullback of y times the pullback of dx divided by the pullback of x squared plus the pullback of y squared. You can just pass everything through in a very easy way. You kind of had to use some properties in order to get to this. So you had to trust me a little bit, especially on the passing it under. And essentially what's happening, or if you want, maybe to make it less weird, we have the pullback of x divided x squared plus y squared. OK, this is better. It's less weird. Times the pullback of dy minus the pullback of y over x squared plus y squared times the pullback of dx. This is better. This is just the property that the pullback to the wedge product is the same as the wedge product of the pullbacks. Because this thing here is a zero form. And this thing here is a one form. So you cannot see it, but there's a wedge product hidden in here. It's just that when I add zero form, wedge something else, the wedge just disappears. And at this point, this is just a precomposition, which means all I'm doing is I have x composed with cosine t, or with the pullback of this thing, for example, really x over x squared plus y squared composed with cosine of t. But the x coordinate of cosine t sine t is cosine t. So the reason why I'm showing you this is essentially what you're doing is just replace all of the x's with cosine of t, replace all of the y with sine of t. It becomes as simple as that. So this pullback thing allows you to do things without having to worry about taking derivatives and all of the stuff. So you just take every x that you see and replace it with cosine, and y replace it with sine. So you're going to get cosine of t over cosine t squared plus sine of t squared. And then we use the property that the exterior derivative passes through here. So we have gamma star of this is going to be d of gamma star of y. And then we have minus sine of t over cosine of t squared plus sine of t squared. And then d of gamma star of x. These things are just going to be one. So you get cosine of t, which multiplies d of sine of t, minus sine of t, which multiplies d of cosine of t. Because again, we're just replacing, when we have gamma star acting on y, we just replace y with sine of t. And this is just going to be d of sine of t. Again, you use the chain rule. So it just becomes cosine of t squared. And d of cosine t becomes minus t minus sine of t. So you get plus sine of t squared, which is 1. So this means that gamma star omega equals 1. Which is the simplest thing you can think of. Yes?
Should have a detail.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry.
Okay, yeah, that's
right. Good point. Yes, I forgot here, so this whole thing should multiply dt. Thank you. So now when you do the integral of gamma star omega on 0 to 2 pi, this is the integral from 0 to 2 pi of dt, which is 2 pi, which is not 0. So by contradiction, the form cannot be exact, even if it's closed. So what's happening is that thing that happened here, we removed one point, it changed the topology of the space. Now the space has a hole in the middle, and having a hole in the middle changes whether exact forms are those forms are exact. And that's an important question. So even when you think about electromagnetism, if your space actually has a hole in the middle, the potentials are not necessarily existing. So this is an important thing to take into account. Okay, we're a bit over time. Sorry about that. Any questions?
I have some questions about integrability. You said that only top forms are integrable.
Yes.
But you can have, not all of the exact forms are top forms. So it means that not all of the exact forms are integratable.
Yeah, so you can integrate things that are not exact. You can integrate any kind of thing. It doesn't have to be exact. If it's exact, then the integral is easier. This is a simple form of Stokes' theorem that we're going to see. So if you do the integral of a closed form, sorry, an exact form, then it's easier to do because you have some properties you can use.
So
otherwise,
should be integratable, but
not every exact form. It also needs to be a top form.
Yes, that's the question.
Yes.
So exact forms integratable because when we have an exact form, it means that we can.
Because you can have exact forms which are one forms. And you have a space of dimension 4, and then you cannot integrate them.
Can you always find a subset of the manifold that?
Yes, you can integrate over a subset. Just it depends on what you're trying to do. If you want to integrate a one form, you need to integrate it over a curve, or a one-dimensional subset. You cannot integrate it over the whole thing just because it doesn't work. Dimensions need to match.
Yeah.
That's the same thing that you do with integrals in calculus. If you want to do a double integral, you need to integrate two things. You cannot do a single integral or in two dimensions, unless you do a line integral, but then you're doing an integral over a curve that's a subset of your space. Yes?
Every closed form can be exact after taking something like
that. Can you repeat that?
Every closed form can be exact form after...
No, so every exact form, if you take the pullback, is... If you take the pullback of a closed form, it's still closed. If you take the pullback of an exact form, it's still exact. If you take the pullback of a closed form which is not exact, you may end up with something which is exact in the other space. That's something that can happen. But it's not something that always happens. It's just a possibility.
Then in that case, how can we show that it is not an exact
form? It's not always easy to show that something is not exact. The simplest thing to do is something like this. You use a property that exact forms have, show that it doesn't work. So you essentially do a contradiction proof. So we know that exact forms, the integral depends only on, at least for curves, it only depends on the endpoints. And therefore, you're going to have, if you do the integral and you get a number which is not zero, then you found the contradiction. If the number is zero, that doesn't tell you anything, because you only choose one curve. So you will need to try every possible curve, and that's a lot of them. So it's not always obvious how to find it. You just need to use some properties. So being closed is a necessary condition to be exact. Necessary condition, because exact implies closed. So if something is not closed, that's easy to do. Just do the exterior derivative. If it gives you zero, it's closed. Otherwise, it's not. So that's an easy way to check if something can be exact. Just check if it's closed first. If it's closed, then it might be exact. So at the point is, you either try to find exactly what the, if you want to write it as alpha equals the beta, one thing you can do is find beta. If you can write it exactly like this, then you're done. Otherwise, you can use theorems. So when I told you that removing the points creates problems, if you don't remove the points, this always works. On Rn, exact forms are always closed, and closed forms are always exact. So that happens in topological spaces that look like Rn. If they don't have any holes, everything is fine. So it becomes a topological property. It's not a local property. It doesn't depend on how things look close to a point. It depends on the whole space. Because even if I have a manifold, I'm looking at something here. So I'm only looking at things locally. But there's this point here that I'm removing. What happens here depends on this point. So it's a global property because it depends on the whole thing, not just what happens locally.
Unless someone gives you an exact form like that, says alpha is equal to d beta, there is no way to concretely show that it's that a form is exact? Because you said it's just a proof of contradiction. If you find the integral and it's not a zero, then you can say it's not exact.
You're essentially doing an integration, because if I do it in coordinates, this is essentially a differential equation.
Yeah.
So you are solving a differential equation. If you can solve it, then yes. Otherwise, you can use essentially Poincaré's lemma. If your space has the nice topological properties you need, then you just, Poincaré tells you, and we trust him, that exact forms, closed forms are always exact under certain assumptions. So that's what we do when we do electromagnetism, and then we say, oh, we're working in Rn, R3 or R4, depending on whether you do space-time, and then you say, well, the vector potential always exists. I don't have to worry about it. I just say B equals the curl of A. You can do it because Poincaré says you can do it. Not only, but in Rn it works. And then if the space has topological things you need to worry about, then you need to worry about them. And it doesn't mean that when I do this, I remove a point. This doesn't mean that every closed form must be not exact. It just tells you that there are some closed forms which are not exact. Yes?
Can you remind me maybe So closed implies exact when the manifold forms the final soft star shape, right? Or somehow here the only reason why it does not work is because R2, if you remove the zero, it has not a star shape, or I don't know how you call it.
Yes. Yeah, so if you change with where the form lives, so if the form is not actually defined at this point, but it's actually, or if you get exactly this form, for example, if you restrict it to here, you just take all the positive, so the half space, you just take the y greater than zero, which also does not include this point, but doesn't include the line here as well. Then restrict it to the space, that form is exact. In the sense that if you say it's zero everywhere else, essentially, well, you can't really say it's zero everywhere else in an easy way, but you are restricting your manifold to a submanifold, then in that case, everything is fine. But the reason why it's fine is that this manifold, the one that has, let me do it dashed, the set of all the x, y, such that y is greater than zero, this is pretty much the same as Rn, or R2. Topologically speaking, also as a smooth manifold, they are the same. You're just stretching one dimension, the y dimension, but everything else is the same. So you can find the diffeomorphism between the two things. So in that case, you are back into the Poincaré lemma scenario and everything works.